Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, November 18th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we have Money and Markets, and then Ask Catherine Lots of Questions, then a discussion with Axel Merck, President and Chief Investment Officer of Merck Mutual Funds in Palo Alto, California. I'm speaking to you from Philadelphia. Last week, I drove from San Francisco to Tennessee, and then this past weekend, I drove from Tennessee to Philadelphia. And I must say that the drive, which was about 60 hours, reminded me of how large and how spectacular America is. It's quite an experience to drive across country, and I've now done it so many times that every time I stop in a place, it's sort of a deja vu. Oh, I've been here before. I'm working in Philadelphia through the end of December, and from the offices of our bank at National Bank of Malvern. If you're interested in community banking and finding a great local bank, I would really encourage you to listen to the Solari report we did on banking locally. It was an interview of the leadership of National Bank of Malvern, which also happens to include some of my cousins. Anyway, but it's a great guide, and there's lots of good information if you've decided to find a good local bank. One of the reasons that I'm in Philadelphia is I have a very dear childhood friend who's dying, Georgie LaRue. If you read the Dylan Reed story, you can see a picture of her. She was holding the Bible when I was sworn in during the Bush administration. And to support Georgie, I find myself navigating between her independent living community and the assisted living and nursing facility she's going to, as well as a local hospital where I've been visiting her, but she's now moved into the assisted living. And I'm learning more every day about the challenges of the American healthcare system, and it's really concerning. And it's one of the reasons I'm so glad on December 2nd we're going to be joined by Charles Murray, who's the president of the American Institute for Economic Research. And we're going to focus on one of their many very excellent publications. It's called If Something Should Happen, How to Organize Your Financial and Legal Affairs. It's a manual full of checklists. It's really a workbook to help you do it. And it's very important information to help ensure that your affairs are protected and organized in the event of illness or an accident or anything that leaves you or your family or your assets vulnerable. Our theme tonight comes from a quote in our interview with Axel Merck, which we recorded this afternoon. Axel said, quote, "There are no safe assets." Axel's right. There are no safe assets. However, there are valuable assets and there are useful assets, but all assets have risk. And it's really a matter of looking through a politically managed situation into what has fundamental human and economic value and what lasts. And it really comes down to understanding and believing in your own judgment. It's in the absence of real markets, we're each called to develop a much stronger understanding of what is real and what has value. Market prices are not necessarily going to tell us, and political change can put all value at risk. Money and markets. Well, a lame duck Congress is revving up to pass food safety and is considering more controls on the internet. It's deeply disturbing, but it's what we've talked about many times before. The greater the debt, the more unstable the system. The more unstable the system, the greater controls sought. The greater the controls, the less productive the system. The less productive the system, the more dependency on debt grows, and around we go. Sadly, there was an announcement of a new study. The members of Congress, between 2008 and 2009, their personal assets grew 16%, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Not so wonderful. The media, both the TV and the blogosphere, is pushing a scandal about full-body scanners in the TSA. I'm getting about 20 or 30 emails on the topic a day. To me, it looks and smells like a professional op. It's designed to look like a grassroots uprising. However, there's too much material. It's too professional. It's showing up in too many places, and the whole thing smells of something other than grassroots. That said, and it's surprising, many of the subscribers in my network have emailed me asking the same thing. One person said, you know, is there something funny here? I haven't sent this around because I think there's something funny here, which tells me he's learning. Anyway, but it tells me we're getting smarter and smarter as a group. So what's it about? I don't know. The full-body scanners and pat-downs are nowhere near as important as the constitutional powers now being trampled on by the proposed food safety or any of the internet legislation under consideration. So is it a distraction? It could be. Is it someone who's just trying to get the contract switched or the head of the agency switched, you know, which is sometimes, you know, what this comes down to, somebody trying to control the pot of money and power at the particular agency that's being, this is what we call being swarmed. I don't know, but there clearly is a hidden agenda, and it's important to be careful. It's not a little bit like the announcement of a new NATO missile shield right after we have an unknown missile sighted in Los Angeles. You know, again, you want to know, is there a coincidence? Who knows? But the coincidence and the timing was pretty remarkable. In the equity markets, the General Motors IPO came to market. The IPO puts the total GM value at about $63 billion, way down from its top. The offering now is at about came out at about $23.1 billion, which makes it the largest IPO for the year, topping the by about $1 billion, the Agricultural Bank of China that came in July. The offering was led by Morgan Stanley. We have J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and Citicorp, all the bringers of the the housing and derivatives bubble. They're going to make about $273 million in fees on the deal. That's in the first market. I'm sure they're positioned to make a lot of money in the aftermarket. We often on Wall Street made more in the aftermarket trading the deal, which ran up quite a bit today and then backed off. Came out, the price it came out at represents a loss to the Treasury. So the Treasury is losing a fair amount of money on sort of the money they put in. And but they're left with about a 33% position. Of all the extraordinary things about this offering, now think of it, it's the largest offering of the year. GM says in their prospectus, and we thank NPR for pointing this out in an article, Three Funny Things about the GM IPO, the company said in their prospectus, quote, "Our disclosure controls and procedures and our internal control over financial reporting are currently not effective." Now, this takes my breath away. I thought when I was on Wall Street that if your financial reporting and internal controls and disclosure controls and procedures were not up to a certain standard, that you couldn't do an IPO, let alone the biggest one of the year. Now, it's not surprising that General Motors shares this quality with its largest shareholder, the U.S., still in for 33%. After all, the U.S. Treasury has defied for 15 years the laws required to have audited financial statements and is missing trillions of dollars, so it somehow seems appropriate. In the precious metals market, we have gold showing both a strong ceiling and a strong floor. The central banks seem to want to keep the price from going up the S curve, and yet every time the price gets pushed down, it's amazing how much opportunistic buying comes in. It keeps coming back much faster than I expect it to. The gold-silver ratio is dropping a little bit again. Last week, Franklin described he's looking to trade at 47 with money changer clients. We've been discussing the same question at Solaris Silver and Gold and are still not ready to recommend a trade. Our clients are often made more recent purchases than the money changer, and it's very important to us that the trading makes sense in terms of both commissions and transaction costs, which should not be a major portion of the realized gain, we believe. The other thing is I think it's very important that that swapping not occur with investors who are just beginning to invest in precious metals. One alternative is, of course, to just ride straight to a 15-to-1, which is the sort of peak in the, or traditionally the peak in a bull market in gold and silver. And we clearly, if we're at 50, we've got a long way to go. So we're a little bit less eager to trade and now are discussing at what number we might be encouraged to recommend it. My prediction for the year, I was asked today my expectation for precious metals for the first quarter, and the answer is I don't have one yet. My prediction for gold for the year had been $1,350. I still haven't upped that. The price clearly has run up above $1,400 and is now back down a little bit above $1,350. If anything, the driving variable in my thinking for 2010 was how much was not how much fundamental demand would increase the price, but rather how much the central banks would permit the price to rise. And it's important to understand that the people who manage and govern the financial system, as I explained last week, I believe they want a rising gold price and they want a falling dollar, but in a managed process. So they're going to continue to manage that process, and so they're going to be intolerant of really big jumps. And I've been listening since 2005 to the gold bugs, even before then, you know, predict that gold is going to, you know, fantastic increases from a percentage term in a short period of time. We've never seen it happen, or rarely seen it happen, and I just don't. You know, I continue to think that the managed process and the central bankers will hold a ceiling on it. Max Keiser's captured a lot of attention, as everybody knows me knows. I love Max Keiser. He's recommending that if everybody just buys a silver coin, the result will be that J.P. Morgan will get squeezed. They hold a very significant short position on silver. And I think it's a great idea. However, I would point out that the bank's short position, I believe, is ultimately held by the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a fund of the U.S. Treasury, which means whoever holds the position, J.P. Morgan Chase, has the option to put it back to the taxpayers. Now, that said, I still think it's a great idea, but my belief is that the investors who control J.P. Morgan Chase are net long precious metals, and ultimately, if we do what Max recommends, they'll make money, and the U.S. taxpayers will end up eating the losses. That said, I think we need to get to a sound currency system one way or another, so everybody buying silver is a good idea to me. My hero this week is Bob McIlvaine and Tony Sambodi, who were on Geraldo. Bob is one of the 9/11 family. He was a father. His son was killed at the World Trade Center. And Tony is one of the architects in a wonderful group, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. My hero keeps being, you know, I keep bringing up 9/11 guys, but it never ceases to amaze me the courage that people like Bob and Tony show in doing this. I put the little video of their interview up on the blog, so you can see it there. The reality is that, they were talking on Geraldo about the explosion or the demolition of Building 7, which was a building that had a tremendous amount of government offices in it, and that includes documents and all sorts of securities and other investigations and prosecutions. And I dare say, Wall Street made out quite well on the demolition of Building 7. Anyway, so it's kind of worth watching it, and you wonder how in the world did this get on national TV? Okay, many questions in Ask Catherine. First of all, we got a question on the use of silver in the Manhattan Project. That one was new to us, and so I had David Lichty research it. He's just a marvelous researcher, and so we wrote a little blog post. It's up on the blog. We also got a question about the U.S. Treasury, and this is the kind of question you see occasionally bouncing around on the Internet, basically saying, is it really true that the U.S. Treasury is incorporated and essentially located in Puerto Rico? Again, I had David research that one. We find no evidence. You know, I'm happy to entertain the possibility of any crazy thing being true, but we need evidence and documentation. As far as we can tell, there is none. I do sometimes get concerned about looking or allegations for which there's no evidence that are pretty far out there. When the evidence of things which are outside the Constitution and are clearly illegal and criminal are so compelling, I would love to get more sort of interest away from questions like Puerto Rico and focusing on the black budget mechanisms that have been put into place. There are many of them. And the fact that that we're in complete violation of all the laws on financial management at the Treasury and the covered agencies, and trillions of dollars have gone missing from the federal government. All of this is completely criminal and illegal, and yet we continue to sort of issue and many of us buy securities issued by the federal government, even though they're basically running a financial operation which is under the law criminal. But anyway, you know, whether they're in Puerto Rico or not, no evidence to suggest that that's the case. I got a wonderful comment from a subscriber who had tried to access a foreign investment operation and was given a little warning that the site was off limits to people from the United States. And the question was, are we literally and the question was, are we being firewalled off by the sort of by the global financial system? Actually, what's happening is, if you look at the reforms in the financial reform bill and a variety of different bills, what you'll see is that real barriers have been put up against Americans investing directly with foreign financial institutions. And, you know, there's all sorts of reporting requirements both by the foreign financial institutions and both by, and sometimes by Americans. As a result, it makes it trickier and more expensive. But what is happening all around the world is that more and more financial institutions are making a determination that they cannot afford to do business with the U.S. government, or cannot afford to do business with American citizens. And my guess is that what they're trying to do is to make sure American retail capital has to channel through American institutions. So this will not prevent investment abroad, but the investment that occurs abroad will have to be channeled through American financial institutions, American mutual fund companies. So basically, Americans' capital is being toll-boothed by the American financial institutions who want to maintain control. They're perfectly happy to see your money get invested in China as long as it goes through them. They get the fees, and ultimately they get to sort of direct who's in and who's out, you know, in those regions of the world. So is this a serious development? Yes, but it's been creeping up on us now for about 15 years, and it's just getting to a point where many big institutions are cutting us off. Foundation X, I put up in topics a very strange video of an MP in Parliament talking about being approached by a foundation with you know, more money than you can possibly imagine, looking to save the world. And it had been sent to me by somebody saying, you know, what in the world is this? Well, it's interesting. I have on numerous occasions over the last 10 years been approached by someone saying that they were representing that foundation, or saying that they'd been approached by that foundation and wanted to represent. Now, you know, how many of these scams are there out there? What's always amazing is, no matter what the drill, what the speech, whatever, nothing ever comes of it. And yet, each time it happens, what I say to them, look, if you want me to be involved or do anything, send me a package of disclosure and a retainer check, and then we'll talk. But until I see those two things, I have no interest. And call me when you're real. And every time I say that, you know, they start upping the money from billions to trillions, as though somehow if they have trillions, you know, I will work for free. What's scary about all of this is I'm amazed at how many very intelligent professional people will end up spending an enormous amount of time and run around in circles and just get scammed, you know, following the promise of these many, many trillions of dollars. So I have no idea what the Foundation X story is about. If anything, I put it up to just remind us all that things get stranger and stranger. But also I wanted to discuss the fact that if somebody shows up promising trillions, but they won't write a check for your time and effort or that matches your own, just ignore them, no matter how many trillions of dollars it is. Another question, you mentioned an 80% likelihood of IRAs being confiscated. The question indicates by the end of 2010. No, I said I expected a very high likelihood by the end of 2011 we'll see legislation that I would describe as confiscatory. Now, when I say confiscatory, I don't mean they're going to grab the IRAs. I mean they're going to layer on rules and regulations that, to me, is in essence confiscation. But I assure you it will be done, or it will probably be done pretty subtly. The question involved is, if a person rolled their IRA into goldmoney.com in Switzerland, could it be confiscated, or would it likely be confiscated with currency IRAs in the U.S.? A couple of comments here. The proposal floating around, and we collected up, and I had David Lichty write a wonderful piece. You can access it from the blog or from your cart on the proposals that are currently existing, so you can read all about them to your heart's content. But what they're proposing is that upon withdrawal, the IRA would convert to annuity. So it's not an asset. It's a lifelong earning, you know, it's a right to earn a lifelong cash flow. And I would describe that as confiscatory. I assure you, if they're serious about any of those proposals, that's not how they'll describe it. But in essence, it stops being your money and simply gives you the right to some kind of earned income over a period of time. Now, it's important to understand, if you put money in gold money or any other institution around the world in a self-directed IRA, that institution will obey U.S. law. So if the United States government passes a law that says, take all the money in that IRA and, you know, mail it to the U.S. Treasury, they're going to do it. That's the law. And part of what we've seen with events in Switzerland and other places around the world is the United States are making it very clear that they expect foreign financial institutions to behave this way, which is why we start to see messages on websites saying, you know, you can't, if you're a U.S. citizen, you can't read this website and you can't invest with us. It's, you know, because they don't want to be liable to have to implement more and more of these laws. And in fact, the practical matter of trying to implement them is very expensive and if not impractical and impossible. Another question came along with that one. Will the IRA holder be given the option to opt out, or will it be done and then the holder will be informed? There's no way to know. My hope is that if legislation like this is brewing, particularly because it's so operationally complex with respect to both 401ks, defined benefit plans, and IRAs, I think we'll have plenty of notice of discussion. What period you might have to sort of switch out is anybody's guess. The danger is, as time goes by, my concern is there's more and more reason to grab that money and more reason to also raise taxes. So the penalties and costs of opting out at that time may be higher than they are today. Okay, so that's it for one other great question from, in fact, online. What is a good book you can use to explain local currencies to your local economic development group? I would recommend a fairly old book. It's 1994, self-published by Tom Greco. It's called New Money for Healthy Communities, and it gives you a good sense of the community currencies that have occurred, you know, over the last, really in the history of America. Another one I would really recommend is Franklin Sanders' article on creating silver exchanges in communities, and that's up on our blog, as are some other sort of videos and information about local currencies. I definitely share with them the video of the folks in Indonesia using gold and silver as a currency. I think that video is very inspiring. So I would start there. The E.F. Schumacher has a website that's dedicated, does a lot with local currencies. They tend to do a lot of currencies that I don't think are going to work, you know, sort of community fiat currencies that don't sort of recognize some of the real risk issues involved. There's also on our blog lots of good stuff about the different states passing laws that would facilitate use of gold and silver in transactions within that state, and I would encourage that as well. Okay, on to our interview with Axel Merk. We recorded it this afternoon, and so let's play it now. Well, it's my real pleasure to welcome Axel Merk to the Solari Report. Axel is the author of Sustainable Wealth, Achieve Financial Security in a Volatile World of Debt and Consumption. I've read it. I strongly recommend it. He's also President and Chief Investment Officer of Merck Investments, a Palo Alto, California-based mutual fund company. I've long considered his funds, the Merck funds, to be the really excellent and signature choice if your concern is preserving assets in a world of currency debasement and where credit qualities are changing rapidly. And I also think Axel is one of the clearest thinkers in the currency and bond markets today. So, Axel, it's a real pleasure to have you on the Soleri Report. Welcome.
Hi, you're setting pretty high standard here for me to live up to.
Well, we're going to be talking about the sovereign bond market and then more widely the fixed income markets. We're watching today, you can only get the feeling of a game of musical chairs, both in Europe and the United States. And it's very hard to see what's happening clearly and sort of who's going to get the chair pulled on them. So maybe if we could start with Europe and then go to the United States, just get your picture of what you think is going on with sovereign credits.
Sure. Well, a couple of ways of answering that question. First of all, we don't think we have a Greek sovereign debt crisis or an Irish one. We have a global one.
Right.
And with regard to having the chair pulled from under you, I think what's very noteworthy is that not many chairs have been pulled. Lehman has gone bankrupt, but other than that, when push comes to shove, everybody has been bailed out in one form or another. And that's kind of an expectation that's been priced into the market. Question is, of course, whether that can continue. But be that Ireland, that's probably going to get some sort of bailout soon, or California down the road, odds are that as tough as people are talking, ultimately somebody's going to be there to try to lend a hand, and often it's done through printing money. The key difference in assessing sovereign debt issues, I think, is that a crisis as we have in the Eurozone, in our view, does not necessarily need to translate in a weak currency. And we see that now that with the euro trading much, much higher than in the springtime, although the situation is not necessarily much better in some ways. And in the U.S. at the same time, we are in a very different situation because in the U.S., unlike in the Eurozone, you have a current account deficit. And so in the U.S., when you have a crisis, people have less of an incentive to put money into U.S., and the U.S. is very sensitive to perceptions of economic growth changes, whereas in the Eurozone, you can have lousy economic growth on the backdrop of a strong currency, and I'll be glad to go into that as well.
Well, sure, because if you look at your current positions, you're negative on the dollar and strong on the euro. Is that fair to say?
Yes, very much so. And let me elaborate on that a little bit from numerous perspectives. The first one is, if you listen to what Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, has testified in Congress, and he has said that going off the gold standard during the Great Depression has helped the U.S. recover from the Great Depression faster than other countries. So he believes that by debasing the currency, you can boost economic growth. And he's right. If I take away your purchasing power, you have a greater incentive to work. It's not exactly the mandate of the Fed, but to an extent that philosophy can work. Now, somebody has to be on the other side of that trade, which means that if you're printing less money, and in the Eurozone, by the way, hundreds of billions have been mopped up in liquidity this year, if you print less money, if you spend less money, if it's more painful, if you engage in austerity measures rather than printing money to get out of your problems, what you're going to end up with is lousy economic growth on the backdrop of a strong currency. And people are puzzled when I say that about the Eurozone. At the same time, the same thing applied to Japan, not too many people are surprised about. In Japan, another country that doesn't have a current account deficit, that finances its deficits domestically, in Japan we've had a lousy economy for 20 years. Yet we have a strong currency. And the key here is that on the one hand, the deficits in Japan have been financed domestically. And secondly, the key thing in Japan is they've had a government that's been in disarray. There have been 9 finance ministers in Japan since 2006. They've had a change of government, many prime ministers. Well, what that means is that you can't spend money very effectively because you don't have a clear path. You can't exert pressure on the Bank of Japan to debase the currency. And the market forces are playing out. Consumers are saving more, and the currency gets stronger. Now, by all means, there are major issues in Japan down the road as the population is aging. There are major issues in the Eurozone. But still, for the time being, you can have a very strong currency despite all the problems you have on the sovereign level.
Right. Now, we saw a lot of tension at the recent G20 meeting. What do you think the Americans were trying to get accomplished, and what do you think happened? Where did they come out from that?
Well, many things. First of all, the timing of the quantitative easing announcement probably couldn't have come at a more awkward time where Ben Bernanke announces quantitative easing, QE2 is here. Just as everybody was trying to blame China for the problems, the G20 turned out to be a love fest of everybody else in the world to blame the U.S. for all things that are wrong in the world. Ultimately, of course, it's always easier to blame foreigners, be that in the U.S. or be that anywhere else in the world. Now, as far as the U.S. is concerned, I already mentioned that Bernanke has said going off the gold standard has been beneficial. He has also said a weaker dollar is not necessarily inflationary, pointing to the past, where a weaker dollar typically has not translated into high inflation. I disagree with that same will apply in the future, and I can go into that. But beyond that, the Federal Reserve is putting actions into words by buying government securities, and these securities are now intentionally overpriced. As a result, rational investors will look elsewhere, domestic and foreign investors. And so we believe that the Fed strategy is very clearly to debase the U.S. dollar. Now, in the context of the G20, other countries, of course, have to react to that. And a lot of what we've seen is bashing of the U.S. Now, the one thing we have to be aware of, that every country in the world, including the U.S., including China, will act in what they believe is in their best interest. And I say believe because it's not necessarily their interest. But right now, the U.S. and the Federal Reserve in particular is putting the gun at China's head and say, you have to do something, especially with regard to your currency, otherwise you're going to import our monetary policy. And so the rest of the world has to think about, well, how are they going to act? How are they going to play this out? And there are a couple of ways of doing that. One is through protectionism, such as the path that Brazil wants to go down on. And by the way, the reason why the 1930s turned into the Great Depression is because the best intended policies turned into a trade war. And right. Brazil says World War II started the last time competitive devaluations happened. Now, at the other end of the spectrum are countries like New Zealand, Australia, or Sweden that firmly embrace free-floating exchange rates, do not believe intervention helps, do not think protectionist measures help. And so those countries will just say, all right, we have to deal with this new world. The U.S., we may not like what they do, but we just have to cope with it. And ultimately, of course, all of this is just going to accelerate a transformation into a world that should be less dependent on what the U.S. is doing. China also has to move in that direction. And the danger, of course, is the politicization. And there we have to think about, is that barking we heard mostly just catering to the domestic audiences, or is this a sea change where we're going to see more protectionism and more things that are seriously going to hurt the global economic recovery?
Now, why do you think that despite all of the debasement we've seen over the last 10, 15 years, we haven't experienced hyperinflation? How have interest rates stayed so low?
Hyperinflation is a loaded word, and that is something that may happen, of course, down the road. Historically, the U.S. has pursued better policies than much of the rest of the world has, and so there's a lot of built-up confidence in the Federal Reserve, and many people believe that, oh, yep, we have this and this and this, and if the Fed needs to print a little bit of money, well, okay, not yet the rest of it. Now, think about it also. What are the choices for the rest of the world? Where can China diversify its reserves to? And unlike most people, I'm not so concerned about the lack of quality in alternatives. I'm worried about the lack of depth, meaning that China is not too concerned about putting its money into the euro, despite the crisis that's happening there. But what China has as an issue is that they have so much money to deploy that they need to have liquid markets. One of the advantages of issuing so much debt in the U.S. is that we have the deepest fixed income markets in the world. In the Eurozone, Germany in particular, one of the reasons why German banks are involved in every single crisis in the world is because German savers are putting so much money into German banks, and conversely, the domestic fixed income markets in Germany are not developed enough, and so Germany has to go elsewhere. The best thing that can happen to the world is if Asian countries in particular develop their domestic fixed income markets so they're less dependent on funding in U.S. dollar. Now, of course, with the flare-up we had in the G20, with the increased protectionism that may come up, that's again going to discourage people to deploy money in Asia, and it's going to prolong this a world that's more stable, and that's a very unfortunate thing because development of global fixed income market is really what we need. There's a reason why people put their money into the U.S., because despite all the criticism, we can take the money out of the U.S. if we want to. In many other countries, that may not be the case. And so that's kind of one primary reason why the system has held together, because the type of quote-unquote abuse that's been happening isn't as severe enough as for people to take cover. Now, at the same time, look at the municipal bond market in the U.S. It's been going stronger and stronger until it didn't anymore about a week or two ago, and that may unleash an avalanche. So irrational things can happen for a long time, but at some point something will crack, and we saw that in the housing market. At some point, prices don't go up forever anymore. We see that in the long run, and of course it may happen. The question is always, what is the risk of something happening? And then as a result, will I chase the trend or will I take a precaution that that scenario actually plays out?
Well, at the same time, one of the things we've seen for quite a while now is literally sovereign governments printing paper, whether it's currency or bonds. And so when I say musical chairs, you know, we clearly have more debt than we can, as a global economy, as we can service under current conditions. And so to me, at the heart of this, the question is, do you want to be invested in real things or do you want to be invested in financial assets? And the question is, are we going to get a fundamental pricing between real things and financial assets? And I think that's part of why we see precious metals headed up. So, if I'm the Chinese, how much money do I want in financial assets and should I instead convert as much of that as possible into the real things I'm going to need, into strategic resources? And that's why we see more and more of them buying into equities and just trying to take positions in the kinds of assets that they need.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I fully agree. The global debt to GDP ratio is higher than it's ever been in peacetime before. There's over 100% debt to GDP ratio in the world. The Western world is bankrupt. And that is the very reason why precious metals are doing so well, because ultimately the way to address that is through inflation. Now, mentioning about China, for example, diversifying, one of the challenges that China has had, and China is a fairly prudent player in the markets, they like to talk their own book, but they are a fairly prudent player, is that when they increase their gold reserves, they don't want to disrupt market prices too much.
Right.
And so while they have steadily been buying gold, as a percentage of their reserves, it's actually been going down because their reserves are growing so fast that they can't buy gold fast enough. That doesn't mean that diversification doesn't happen, but those are the types of limitations they have, because ultimately the commodities market and the precious metals markets in particular are just far less liquid than the currency markets are. One of the advantages of fiat money is you can print all of it, so you have more liquidity. I mean, as cynical as that may sound. And so what China has been doing is China has been trying to diversify, but when they started buying U.S. assets, well, most of the stuff the Chinese want, Americans don't like to sell, because those are strategic things. And so they've been buying more things in Australia and Northern Africa and Latin America and Canada, wherever they can, and they'll accelerate that. Now, the challenges, though, is that even though I fully agree that purchasing power over the long run may be best preserved with hard assets, the volatility in these assets can be rather dramatic. Silver can move 10% in 2 hours. And so how much of your money can you have in assets that are that volatile, and how much do you need to have in assets that are less volatile with regard to the currency that you're based in? And so it's not an easy question. One of the things I have been saying many times over is that there is no such thing anymore as a safe asset, and investors may want to take a diversified approach to something as mundane as cash. Central banks are diversifying their reserves, and so as a result, investors may want to consider doing the same thing, and their financial assets are likely to play an important role as well.
Right. Well, there's no way the tangibles can get you the liquidity you need and the volume you need. So the question is, how do you use the fixed income markets? Because I remember when I was on Wall Street in the 80s and working with the fixed income markets, it was a different world than it is today. So, we're looking at incredible volatility compared to what we used to have.
Well, in some ways, the volatility is very healthy. Volatility means that people are thinking. People are disagreeing on price. If there's one healthy thing about the state that we're in right now is that we have different opinions of where we're headed. And you need that. The best bubble indicator in the world, and I mentioned that in my book, is that that you have a lack of volatility in an asset class when tech stocks always go up, when housing prices always go up, or in the current environment where long-term bond prices seem to always go up, and people don't take it seriously when we have this little uptick in volatility. In the bond market, if we take that as an example, historically there is substantial volatility in the long bond. And right now we haven't had that. As a result, there's a lot of money chasing into that field that has no business in being there. And by all means, that has to have an ugly ending, just as it always has. And so from that point of view, volatility is something that's in some ways to be embraced. The challenge we have in the current world is that policymakers are getting ever more involved in the markets because the markets are not moving the way they want them to move, and they're throwing trillions around. Now, when you throw trillions around, markets are moving. The problem is they all move in tandem, and there is no place to hide when the market thinks, oops, we haven't spent and printed enough money, the deflationary wave takes back over. All asset classes come down in tandem. And it's one of the reasons why we have migrated to currencies over time, is because in the currency space, at least, you can design a portfolio that may have a low correlation to anything else investors may be holding. But at the same time, that challenge will persist. The move in tandem by all these asset classes is a direct reaction to the engagement of the policymakers, where people are trying to predict or chase what policymakers are doing rather than the fundamentals of the companies they're investing in.
Do you find yourself spending more time following the politics than finding the fundamental economics?
By all means. I mean, 20 years ago, I used to look at fundamentals of companies. These days, I look at macro themes. That's why we have shifted from being a traditional advisory business to being a mutual fund business that focuses mostly on macro decisions to make decisions on currencies. It's because we live in a different world, and I might as well focus on what I think I understand, because I don't understand the valuations of businesses anymore when they're well-being is just dependent on how close their relationship is with the Federal Reserve.
Right, exactly. Now, I just have to ask you this question. If you were the chairman of the Federal Reserve, would you be doing QE2?
No, but at the same time, the one thing I'd like to point out is that you, I, many others are often very critical of our policymakers. And the one noteworthy thing is that have you ever noticed a change in tone when a policymaker retires or before a policymaker becomes appointed? People tend to be far more pragmatic when they're in office. So it's very easy for us, of course, to criticize them. Now, having said that, with regard to the Bernanke policies, I think hands down I can say, yes, it is absolutely the wrong approach that the Federal Reserve is pursuing. And the reason is that any policy is most effective when it works with market forces. The reason why this economy doesn't go anywhere is because we're trying to subsidize an ailing consumer. We don't allow the downsizing of consumers that is absolutely necessary. A consumer that cannot afford a house is best served by downsizing to a home they can afford, and then they can build up discretionary income again. Now, any downsizing is political suicide because it means foreclosures, bankruptcies, and things like that. And so what the Federal Reserve is trying to do is they can't encourage people to earn more money. That hasn't worked in 10 years. And so they're trying to push up the price level. That is a very, very frustrating game because consumers want to downsize. A deflationary trend would set in, and the Federal Reserve doesn't like it, and they stem against that trend. They throw so much money at the problem. Well, the money doesn't stick because consumers don't want it. Banks don't have creditworthy borrowers. And so that money ends up where you have the greatest monetary sensitivity. That's precious metals. That's currencies outside of the U.S. dollar. And, of course, if you throw enough money at the problem, some of that will stick. And, indeed, the worst nightmare for the Federal Reserve would be if that money actually stuck. Because think about it. We actually get economic growth that's substantial. How on earth are they ever going to mop up that liquidity anymore? Technically, it's difficult but possible, but yeah. On a practical side, we have so much leverage in the consumer that just a little bit of tightening will have an amplified effect. And so if and when the Federal Reserve does tighten, we're going to have an extremely volatile Federal Reserve policy because the economy is going to plunge right again. The Federal Reserve is going to be so afraid that they have to undo all the quote-unquote good they have been doing. And we have seen Bernanke say that one of the mistakes in the Great Depression was that tightening happened too early. And so they're going to err on the side of inflation, almost certainly in my view. And so we're going to be on this, in the best case scenario, we're going to have a very volatile Fed policy. And for the time being, the Federal Reserve can get away with murder because the money doesn't stick. So for the time being, we don't get this hyperinflation you talk about. But at the same time, if this economic growth does kick in, it's going to be very, very difficult to move on from there. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons why we're far optimistic about the Eurozone, because in the Eurozone, we don't have that leverage.
Yeah.
First of all, they have mopped it up, but also, it's not just in recent weeks that the European Central Bank has had a different policy. For the past 10 years, the ECB has been far tighter because they have tried to impose structural reform on the Eurozone, keeping the Eurozone on a shorter leash. As a result, German consumers stopped spending 10 years ago. So these days, we don't have to be afraid of the European consumer falling off a cliff because they're already down there. And so if we need to tighten in the Eurozone, well, people don't like it, but it's not the end of the world. We simply could not have a Volcker-style policy now in the U.S. It would cause a revolution, complete collapse of the system. And so we don't have a flexibility in the U.S. that we have in the Eurozone. And it may say awkward to talk about flexibility in the Eurozone, but as far as monetary policy is concerned, they are far more flexible with what they have. They're printing less money. They're spending less money. And through that, I believe, at the end of the tunnel, they'll come out much better. At least they're trying to address their problems now, whereas we have this magic wand that we are applying generously, the printing press, the government comes to the rescue of every single problem, and as a result, we're creating bigger and bigger distortions in the economy.
Well, but I see the problem in the Eurozone and the problem here is very similar in that we keep centralizing control of the economy in a way that ultimately hurts fundamental productivity. And part of that is moving to politically managed markets instead of markets, not letting markets work.
In some ways, I agree. But there is still, if you think about it, Europe is traditionally far more bureaucratic than the U.S. is.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there are a couple of businesses that are doing absolutely fabulous job in the Eurozone. Businesses
right.
do adjust, and political interference, in some ways, increases the barrier to entry. In the Eurozone, it's very bureaucratic. That means larger companies have a better chance of succeeding. Now, obviously, in the long run, that's not very healthy for an economy, but there are some great companies in the Eurozone. So they have learned to deal with that sort of environment. The key thing that I'm concerned about is, and I think that's where we're in agreement, is that for the larger issues, such as the health of the banking system, you have to work with the market forces. You cannot have a super regulator that's going to pick the winners and losers. You're going to have to find a mechanism that will withdraw funds from a bank that's pursuing bad policies, a market-based mechanism, without wrecking the system. And so nothing in the financial reform, either in the Eurozone or in the US, unfortunately, addresses that properly.
Okay, well, let's turn to personal finance, because I think one of the strengths of your book, Sustainable Wealth, is that you help the reader connect what's going on in the wider markets that we're talking about now, the themes you follow, with sort of the world that they control and what they can do to protect themselves and to build family wealth in this kind of period. And maybe if we could start, and you could explain what you mean by sustainable wealth.
Well, sustainable wealth, it's a very simple concept that you actually can sleep at night with your investments, that you don't need to worry about how you're going to retire because you're just on a prudent path. And it comes down to very simple prescription that you spend less than what you make. It's a concept that has gotten lost.
What a strange notion, Axel. Where did you get that?
What a strange notion. And if you think about it, most businesses and most consumers don't fail because of a lack of revenue. That's because their expenses are too high.
Right.
And so it's always the same issue. If you think back to your college days, you had a fraction of the income you have today. At the same time, you're probably quite happy. Nowadays, you have a much bigger income, but you have all these worries. Well, there's something wrong there. There's a disconnect here. And the thing is, you just get used to your TiVo on your Netflix and your cell phone and everything that comes with it. And you don't realize that you don't need most of that stuff. And so at the same time, of course, people should be concerned about how they can make money. And then once they have money, how to invest it properly. And there, one of the key challenges that people have is that people always want to chase the next trend. Whereas what people should think about is that what I'm investing in good value? Warren Buffett, for example, didn't understand the tech sector, so he didn't invest in it. Well, he lost out on the boom. He lost out. He didn't happen to be there in the dust. But he did quite okay. It's okay to be on the sidelines if you don't understand devaluation. So there's nobody there who tells you you always have to be in the market. You don't lose money other than, of course, purchasing power if you hold dollar cash or any other cash for too long. But you don't lose your principal necessarily if you're on the sidelines. And so it is absolutely okay to wait for good opportunities. And sometimes for a very long time, there are no good opportunities available.
Good opportunities that you understand.
Well, exactly. And there are many ways to make money. And there is no, there, you don't have to, the point here is that if you're just chasing trends, which most people do that are always in short supply of money, well, you're bound to invest at the top. And so it's worthwhile to do your homework to actually decide that, oh, I only want to buy this because I believe that the price is right.
One of the things you talk about that I'm a great believer in is scenario planning. And I was hoping you would say a little bit about what you, the point you take in, on scenario planning in your book.
Definitely. Scenario planning has been pretty much all my life. I have a master's in computer science, amongst others, and it was done in a probabilistic decision support system. That sounds very fancy, but basically it's scenario planning. And that's how I've grown up. And basically what that means is that if you translate that to the discussion we just had, we talk about the fears of, you talked about hyperinflation, you talked about the threat of the U.S. dollar, we talked about the bond market blowing up. Well, different people will assign different probabilities to these sort of events happening. But if you think that any of these scenarios are possible, you can say, all right, the government is going to come to the rescue, or this is going to happen, we come to our senses. But if you think it's possible that the dollar is at risk, well, why don't you take it into account in your portfolio allocation? And it doesn't, it comes back to, we call them black swans these days, or flat tails, or whatever they may be. They're not likely probabilities, but they're possible. And so if you think it is possible in September 2008 that the financial system collapses, well, why not have a little bit of gold and cash on the side? You don't have to be then the one that says, oh, my God, I put gold aside, but the system didn't collapse. Well, first of all, your gold is worth a lot more than it was then anyway. And more importantly, it's an insurance that allows you to sleep at night. And ultimately, that's what it comes down to. I mean, it's only money, for goodness sake. And so it's keep it on the side. And by the way, the reason I say it's only money, coming to scenario planning, one thing to take note is throughout this financial crisis, some people have lost their homes, but the homes were not destroyed. People have not lost their education. And we've not had a war breakout because of that. It's only been money that we've lost. So we shouldn't really think that, oh, my God, this is the end of the world. We should have the courage to engage in reforms that is meaningful and not ask all the time for the government for help. So, but coming back to your question, scenario planning means that you have a view of how the world is going to be, but at the same time, you're going to take into account different scenarios. Some that are more optimistic and some that are less optimistic, and you make sure that as far as your personal finance is concerned, that you cover your expenses first. When your portfolio goes down 50% in the aftermath of the crisis in 2008, well, odds are that you can risk to afford to, you can afford to lose less. And so it is perfectly rational to reduce your risk profile when you've lost half of your money. Whereas many brokers will tell you, you double down and you're going to capture the upside. Yeah, but it's not responsible to put more money at risk when you have less money. And so you have to pare down your risk profile when you can afford to lose less.
See, scenario planning always leads me back to the importance of having very high quality sovereign debt. Because there are just too many scenarios when that is just the place you want to be. And I have colleagues who argue for all precious metals, and I just say, you know, there are scenarios where a kingdom of Norway is worth more than precious metals.
Well, ultimately, of course, I sympathize with those ideas, but ultimately, even those true believers in gold who think gold is going to be the ultimate thing, and we don't disagree, we think gold is going to do very well in the future, most people don't have all their money into gold. So the question is what you do with some of the rest of it. And when it comes to sovereign debt, not everything is, of course, as good as the credit rating may be, as we've learned with Southern European countries. When we buy the euro, by the way, we've never touched Southern Europe. We buy German or Finnish debt or something in Northern Europe. So by all means, you have to do your homework in any of these things as well. It comes down to a question of diversification. Can you achieve your goals by diversifying to these assets? And some people have said that, well, we don't like the dollar, but everything else is crap too, so why bother? Well, I believe that the U.S. is just far more effective at spending and printing money than the Eurozone is. And
right.
as a result, it is absolutely no surprise that the Euro is much stronger than the U.S. dollar. Now,
right.
does that mean that everything is perfect in the Eurozone? Well, definitely
no.
not.
Right.
But at the same time, the volatility you have in holding, or I'm not saying you should have all your money in the Eurozone, but having a basket of currencies as part of your holdings, that may add value because overall your risk profile is improved. And because I believe the U.S. dollar is going to depreciate at a faster pace, your purchasing power is going to increase.
Now, you and your wife are Swiss, and yet you've moved your business to California. I know certainly a lot of Americans who want to go the other way, and I would love for you to share why you decided to set up shop in the United States.
Sure. First, a minor correction. I was born in Munich, Germany, and my wife is from Finland.
I'm sorry,
you
were both Swiss.
I lived in Switzerland for a long time, and I
uh-huh.
set up my business there, but I did move it over. So from that point of view, by all means.
Uh-huh.
And part of it is I set up my business there after dropping out of a PhD program in London where I tried to combine computer science and finance. And I dropped out of the program because I could never reconcile the two. And when you do finance, every academic paper simplifies the boundary conditions, and as a computer scientist, those are the bugs that crash your programs. That was before flat tails and all that stuff. And so I set up a business then, and I used Switzerland because I knew the environment, regulatory overhead was the least, and then as the business started to grow, I actually decided I have to be where the business is, and at some point, I decided I don't want to have kids grow up in Switzerland. And the reason is that while Switzerland is beautiful, it is so conservative that it's kind of boring. And so when you're young, you want to change the world. And so we looked at other places in the world. We looked at various European places. The challenge is that as much as we criticize about what's happening in the U.S., in other places in the world, the business environment is less favorable. There are more regulations out there. And as I mentioned before, the cost to entry is very high when you have a lot of bureaucracy. And we didn't have the scale as a business at that stage where I thought I'd get a fair chance. And so we looked at the U.S., and I've always had, I used to live in the U.S. before. We've now been here for 10 years. And in the U.S., you have a fair playing field. And we found our niche here, and we're able to build a business here that we're very, very happy with. Ultimately, I think you can live in most places in the world, and what you've got to do is you've got to try to engage yourself domestically and locally to try to change the things you don't like, because there's always going to be something you don't like domestically. And at the same time, of course, I keep a lot of my money in precious metals and baskets of other currencies to try to retain my purchasing power. And so with that, we're trying to achieve what we want to achieve. And by the way, in the U.S., we had the same challenge, of course. I didn't want to raise my kids in New York City. We thought Connecticut was too boring, and so we ended up in Silicon Valley, where we love the entrepreneurial spirit that we have around here, and we very much like it here.
Okay, and so if we come into the Merck website, we see that your logo is the owl, and you've explained to me where that comes from, and I would love it if you would share it with the Solari Report subscribers.
Oh, sure. There are many explanations, but the one that I think that you'd like me to zoom in on is that as some of your listeners may be aware, that the owl is the symbol of Athens, and with that also the Greek currency has always had an owl. Even the modern euro coin has an owl on it. Now, obviously, today the Greek currency isn't worth that much, but 2,000 years ago, the Greek currency is the only currency ever to retain its purchasing power for over 500 years. And what happened was that a little over 2,000 years ago, various precious metal finds happened in Greece, and it turns out that in Athens, the Athenian owl was the standard that set itself apart from the other ones, because there they were most rigorous about not debasing the metals content of their currencies. And by all means, they had problems with deficits, but they introduced austerity measures and various creative accounting means in order to try to not to debase the metals content of their currency. And so that inspiration was one of the main reasons why we've chosen the owl for our company logo.
Well, it's a beautiful logo. How do we keep up with you?
But
if we want to follow your work, what do we do?
Yes, you mentioned one of the websites that we have. It's merkfunds.com. That's merkfunds.com. And we have a newsletter there where we talk about our view of the world, how the dynamics play out quite extensively. We also have a number of white papers there that discuss the currency asset class, discuss kind of more rigorously why we may have a bond bubble, and what you can do to take that into account. And so those are the main ways to do it. We also, for our book, we have a website to support that called sustainablewealth.org. We're not updating that quite as frequently as we would like. So merkfunds.com is the best place to get information, sign up for our newsletter, and then obviously learn about our mutual funds that we have there as well.
How often do you update your holdings? So if we want to see what you're doing,
we try to be as transparent as possible. We publish at least on a monthly basis our holdings on our website. In one of our funds, it's almost real time. We very strongly believe that people should know, especially you mentioned sovereign debt, our hard currency fund invests not exclusively but extensively in sovereign debt paper, and we want to show people that when we hold the euro, what paper we buy. We publish everything down to the last derivative, of which we try not to use many. So we try to be as transparent as possible, really not to surprise investors, that investors look at what we do and then they like it or they don't like it. But we try to be clear in what we're trying to achieve, and then we show people how we achieve it.
Well, Axel, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much for joining us on the Solari Report.
My pleasure.
Okay, Axel Merk, great interview. December 2nd, coming up, we have Charles Murray of the American Institute for Economic Research. Again, we're going to focus on their wonderful workbook, If Something Should Happen, How to Organize Your Financial and Legal Affairs. Our movie is going to be a documentary recommended by a wonderful subscriber called The Art of the Steal. It's a very appropriate, since I'm in Philadelphia, it's about the Barnes Foundation, incredible paintings, collection of Impressionist paintings. Seeing it is, it's sort of eye candy to revisit that wonderful collection and about the engineering of that collection into a downtown building in Philadelphia. It asks a lot of very important questions about how do you put your assets in a trust or other endowment or other vehicle and make sure that those rules and laws are respected. December 9th, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. Then on December 16th, again at the request of a subscriber, Who Rules with Daniel Estulin, the reporter who's covered the Bilderbergers and really tried to ask the question, who is the shadow government? His latest book is Shadow Masters. And then remember, after the holidays, January 7th, we have our year-end wrap-up, a look back at 2010 and a look ahead at 2011. In the meantime, remember, David Lichty, Paul Ferguson, and I are available at Solari Silver and Gold. We want to help you diversify your assets with precious metals and protect yourself from the kind of inflation that Axel and I were talking about. So until Charles Murray on December 2nd, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.